Heavenly Father, and we thank Thee for Thy grace unto us, for the realization that Thou art God and this is Thy universe, and we as Thy children know that You hold all things in Thy hand to protect Thy kingdom, to guide and awaken Thy people, create within them a new responsibility, carry Thy standards before the earth. Pray, our Father, that as Thy people come out of their sleep, they may recognize the source of their danger, they might strengthen their society and establish again the necessary standards that eliminate evil. Lift up, O God, from Thy people the realization of how they must identify themselves with Thee and not permit this identification to be removed from any area of their life, political, social, educational, or in any area related to their society. Pray, our Father, Thy blessing to rest upon this nation. We pray for the elimination of leadership that will not lift up Thy standards to carry this nation forward in that direction. Thy prophetic word would indicate the blessing of Thy kingdom. Pray, our Father, that as we meditate upon these things which are reported tonight, we'll cause us to understand from whence our trouble comes, and what it must be done in the establishment of Thy law to find the security of Thy kingdom and the fulfillment of God. And we say Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven, and we ask it. Amen. We turn tonight to talk about a subject of great significance to each and every one of you because it is an hour of prophetic development, one in which we find the economic and social life of the nation in a strange and unusual swinging unbalance. We turn to the words of Daniel. Daniel came before Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, that had a dream and a vision, but he did not remember what it was. But he was greatly disturbed by it. He wanted the interpretation of it. When Daniel, inspired by the living God, came before Nebuchadnezzar, told him about the course of the pagan powers that sought to rule the world, whose empires would run their course, and whose great significance would be identified by their part in prophecy. And he said, "Thou, Babylon, and thou, O king, art this head of gold." As he introduced the vision to the king of a great and mighty statue, statue had a head of gold, breast and arms of silver, belly of brass, and thighs, legs of iron, toes of iron and clay. Symbolism of what was referred in that dream to the king was the identity, of course, of the symbols of these empires, but especially is this important as it relates to Babylon. For Babylon summed up the total of satanic and evil influence. Had become a tremendous international world metropolis of evil. Here were got together the pagan priests of virtually every pagan philosophy and theology. Here they were welded together in a vast veiled temple of universal worship. Behind the scenes, the strategies of this evil, satanic, serpentine program was to extend through their priestcraft, their manipulation of the thinking of man, a control which would expand throughout the empire which they felt they now dominated to the kingdom of figurehead. To manipulate and extend their power over all the earth until all business and all trade would be dependent upon their permission. Until they could manipulate and control all the currency of the world and all of its money. And thus, through their system of religious fallacy and political economy, Babylon would dominate the entire scene. This they sought to do by the use of troops of force and were feared in that period as the most deadly of all empires in the earth. But the fall of Babylon was prophesied, it did come. And so symbolically, the great nation of Babylon fell, but the mystery of Babylon continued. The mystery of Babylon and its strange priesthood, which spread during the days of Medo-Persia, during its occupation of what had been Babylon, the sites out in the old world were scattered. They would find places of survival like Pergamos, and also in the later continents of Europe, in old Venice, during the days of the Roman Empire, from Pergamos to Palestine, and then to the city site which later was to be developed, Venice, went the merchants of Babylon, strange, mysterious forces that would have great impact upon the world. Few people understood the strategies of Babylon. Few understood that never had there been a people more satanically guided to dominate mankind than the merchants of Babylon. If you were to follow the course of the merchants of Babylon, you would discover that the book of Revelation contains much concerning this symbolism. In the book of Revelation, we are told about the evil forces that would wage war against Christian civilization. They would seek to destroy Christian civilization when it rose to its height of greatness, when great Christian nations assumed their areas of responsibility. The attempt would be to crush and destroy them by the same old Babylonian strategy which they used one time out of the empire of Nebuchadnezzar. Thus it is, we are told, that the system that they operate on is the beast system. And to understand this, we recognize that all the peoples that constitute the non-white race on spiritual seated household, which God establishes with Adam and continues on down to his time, are referred to as Enoch, or beast system. The days of Jesus, when the book of Revelation is unveiled to John, after the ascension, you will note that the beast system symbolized the non-Christian world order, or the peoples that are not of your race. Your race has been marked all through Bible history as the household of God, as the people of God's special attention, because they are his offspring. And as the building of his kingdom is established on righteous law, wisdom, knowledge, and understanding, and great capacities to harness the raw materials of earth and to develop the conditions of plenty in the midst of society. Now we note that from the very beginning of the record of the enemy, it refers to the beast system. And you're told that one of the areas in which it seeks to gain control of the earth is to gain control of all the avenues of trade, to gain control of all areas of economy, so no man can bind or sell unless he puts his hand to do the work of the beast system and uses his intellect and his head to serve the beast system. This is referred to in the 13th chapter of the book of Revelation as the mark of the beast. The mark of the beast in the hand and in the forehead. Some people anticipate that this is going to be some kind of a stamp. And they've been waiting to see a stamp put in people's foreheads before they would recognize that the beast system was around. I want you to know that the mark of the beast in the forehead and the hand is supporting the program that does not belong to the spirit people of God, but belongs to the powers of darkness and the forces of evil that seek to gain the world. When men give their assent to these ideas, when they are swayed by communism, new frontierism, and the grand design, they are moving in the direction of taking the mark of the beast to seek their intellect. When they put their hands to build the kind of economy that stems out of the world communism, that was born in the textbooks of Karl Marx, inspired by all the Luciferian influences that helped to build it. And when they set their hands to accomplish this objective, whether they do it among men in the organization of their labor, to place them under the administration of demagogues who serve this system, whether they accomplish these designs by becoming a part of any manipulation in the field of the economy of society that seeks to bind all men so they can do no business without their permission, they are putting their hands to this project. When I look at the position taken by a great number of political leaders today, I realize that we have more men carrying the mark of the beast in the president's cabinet than we have good, honest Americans. Of course, some people have been carrying the mark of the beast around on their face all the time. Way back in the days when the mark was put on Cain, we discovered whose son he was. And it wasn't long after this that Moses talked about the mark on the countenance of these people who were Luciferian and were the generations of the viper. And he said their mark was not the mark of God's people, and that God had let the mark remain and carry with them. There was factors about them. There was even a wavelength and an order that went out from them that people would eschew. He warned the peoples of God concerning the powers of darkness. I tell you that we have not been as cautious as we should have been in taking the advice which was given to us under inspiration and the selection of those people we permit to come into our country to settle inside of our society or rise to areas of power. One thing we must remember is that the manipulation of the areas of economy and what we call money or moneta is a very, very valuable thing as far as the agents of the world order are concerned. We have long found that a great number of people have been raised to believe they couldn't understand money, so they left that up to the bankers. And then whole areas of bankers were told that they couldn't handle it beyond the direction they were permitted to handle it, because there were some experts at the top who would tell them how they could handle it. But remembering this fact, that money was a very strange and mysterious product, and from somewhere it was being manipulated and doled out, or it was being withdrawn because someone said it was withdrawn. The other day, a banker in conversation said, we can loan about so much, but we're told we can't go any more right now in any direction because they are withdrawing the credit, and they tell us now that money is scarce at the present time until we get over a certain situation which will be acceptable with the banking influences, and they're going to release it again. So the banker couldn't tell you why. He didn't know why either. It's just somebody told him this. So he was an expert on what things were supposed to be worth in comparison to the value of his dollar in his own town. But he wasn't an expert on where the money came from, or why it came, or why it should go, or why it should come. Now we point out to you that we are very much concerned about some of the things that relate to our society. The pattern of money under divine law was to be a medium for the moving of goods which had been created. It was to be a virtual symbol or check against the time, the energy, and the output, both of labor. And since men didn't want to keep or store up the things that they produced, especially in agricultural products, and some things which needed to be consumed to be of value, they therefore had to find some way to take this in bartering goods. And the bartering system was rather an intense problem beyond the exchange of great warehouses. Warehouses in some empires were set up. Some nations and small communities had warehouses where goods that they would consume one among another were exchanged. But the impossibility of hauling backward and forward a tremendous amount of exchange goods for the things which you produce, and attempt to bear off the consumption and the patterns of remaining spoilage, became a problem. And it has gone back so far that long before your race ever walked the earth, they had worked out some solutions for this. In ancient China, as well as in the ancient Sumerian empires which extended down into Mesopotamia, they had decided that there were two things that they could do. In the first place, they could carry about with them the most valuable thing. Now, what was the most valuable thing? Sometimes people think they agree with the ancients as with what was most valuable, but the thing they decided was most valuable is the thing that lasted the longest. They had discovered, and they had ample time and some thousands of years of observation, and when they raided what was left of the treasures of some potentate that had been buried or sealed up, they looked to see what was left and what was the most valuable. And so it was generally decided that one of the most valuable things that remained, that didn't tarnish and didn't canker and didn't rust, was gold. So gold became considered by them a valuable commodity, especially since there seemed to be a relative scarcity of it. There wasn't too much of it around. So men evaluated gold and they wanted gold. And similarly, they found that there were other precious metals. And silver was classified too, because of a relative scarcity of the commodity. Then in circulation, it was considered quite valuable, and men liked things made of silver because even though it tarnished, they could polish on it a little bit just like dust. There were areas where brass was acceptable because it could be shined and because it had certain durability, and they had learned early in the making of brass. There was to be found also the realization that there were many very beautiful baubles to be found in the earth, and that they had their values, and it wasn't long before artisans were polishing them and cutting them, and the gems were a reality. Of course, out of the patterns of antiquity, gems didn't have their origination in any one individual planet, because the jewels, the majesty, and the glory of all the facets of the things of beauty had existed throughout the ages of yesterday, because jewels and diadems of jewels have been used throughout the universe. But as far as the utilization of it, it ran almost to the point of beauty, because in those periods of antiquity, commercial diamonds were not used for drilling or for bracing or for polishing. And so in this instance, the total value of the things man claimed as the most important things, because they lasted longest, were gold and silver and jewels. And he paid more value to gold because it changed not, and very seldom did they have any tarnishing, unless heavily alloyed. Now, significantly, by the days of the Babylonian kingdom, we discover that these priests of Babylon had also found this tremendous desire of people for this untarnishable metal. It's also cited that Lucifer himself, though he had once been an archangel, and in the rebellion against God and in his defeat by the forces of heaven had been cast to earth, had taken a certain fixation in his thinking concerning the accumulation of masses of gold for his kingdom and also the gathering of jewels. In fact, the words from the scripture, "Oh, how art thou fallen, O son of the morning," and his desire to be decked with all the jewels and all the emblems and symbols of the vaccine beauty of some of the objects of creation were marked. But in this instance, we point out to you that Mystery Babylon has always identified itself with one thing. They wanted to establish the economy of the world on the scarcest of commodities, and they wanted to dominate and control that commodity, only feeding it out and getting it back again so that they could reduce all production to slavery and never seek to give a proper reward for production. Now the program God's Kingdom talks about the fact that any civilization must have a way of not only building and moving its goods, but it must have a way of properly exchanging. The most important thing to discover from the standpoint of the balance is from the laborer to the consumer, to the producer and the owner, is what equity does anybody have in any produced good. The most important thing is equity, and therefore the time of the hours that whatever given wage is contracted is the equity of a laborer in the goods that have been produced. And so he must be given some check against a percentage of his goods as his equity. And whereas he may not want it in the goods he's produced, his right to have this from all or any goods is one of the most important facets of an economy of proper reimbursement. Also, the right of the individual to manufacture, create, or make anything which is his, and to synthesize anything which he wants to on the chance that somebody will want the finished project, is the very foundation of the capitalizing of these goods to meet the supply and the demand, and to create demand if there is no demand, if such a demand is worth the risk. But the whole policy of the standards of God's economy is this: that in the staples which were important, the wheat, the rye, the food out of the ground, that there must be a just set of weights and measures. That a just set of weights and measures must mean that there is a given weight, and that weight is not to be shortened and it is not to be lightened. And if we are to compare compensation by established value on a commodity based on the fact that it is plentiful or that it's capable of being produced or there's a human need, that it was to be established, and such an established value was to stand, that this might be depended upon throughout the years. Early Zohar writings of your race, and even going back to the days of the patriarchs, the demand that there be no shortage in the weight or the measure clearly establishes that they evaluated the amount that would be given in exchange, either in energy or labor, or in the gold or the desired commodity and the wheat. And so many of these societies thus set up these standards. It wasn't long before these coins and their equivalent values, based on their scarcities of their desires, were used. And the coinage continued into the Roman Empire. You'll remember that the Latin word which we use today for is moneta. We call it money. But strangely enough, the manipulation of this strange commodity has created more trouble than any other single force on the face of the earth, and the powers of darkness understand that the way to take over a nation, reduce it to slavery, even though it's a great and powerful nation, has gained control of the economy, and then mathematically dishonestly used the use of that control. I point out to you then that we are in a very unique position. When God blessed this great nation, as we have reviewed in the two previous messages, having selected this great continent and endowed it with all of the riches of creation and guided us wittingly in our days of our forefathers to settle here, he had told us that we would have here the treasures of the blessings of the wealth of the hills, that we would have everything that would naturally be the result of properly sowing our food under the blessings of rain and under the assurance of good soil and fine conditions. No nation on the face of the earth has been more blessed than the United States for natural resources for the ability to produce food and for all the combinations that are necessary by climate and by the strange jive of initiative that belongs to God's household. So with this in mind, we have watched this expanding society from the early phase of our colonial life being one of growth and expansion. We note that the earliest days of our fight for independence became based over a battle of independence over taxation. We remember that the process of taxation that bothered our colonial forefathers was that they felt they were being taxed without proper representation. In fact, the secret lie in the organization of Jewish gold buyers and moneylenders in Europe, then under the sign of the House of Redfield, planning a design which goes back to ancient Babylon and to ancient Pergamus, where Jesus said Satan's seat was, to gaining the control of the economy of the new nation, to control its munita when it came into being, until they would be able to manipulate its growth they so expected. What they never had witnessed before was anything as rapid in its development, as growing in its strength, and as carefully blessed as was this nation, because carving fortunes out of our products, mining it out of the earth, expanding the great fertile fields and plateaus of our nation and its great plains into the greatest agricultural developing area of the earth, there seemed to be such an abundance of this nation that though the parasites sought to destroy it, they were unable to reach off enough to crush it. Strangely enough, an additional blessing had come, for the mines of America began to yield the gold that Cortez wished for. They began to yield other precious metals, and early in our national life, we were to establish the standards of money, and we were to set them upon scarce items, yes, and scarce commodities, to be sure, was gold and silver, but not as scarce as it was in other lands, and definitely there was an added value of exchange that was created. There were the bartering slips that had been created in a great number of our agricultural and lumbering communities. And against these, even though there were a shortage of gold to affect them, was the security of production in the early colonial life, in especially our forward communities pressing into the forest and developing its resources, the letter of check from developing companies against production, against company stores, became a principal commodity in the pattern of exchange of labor and of money. Wasn't long before this country, as colonies demonstrated, it could survive, had to produce, and would expand as no society had ever expanded before. And the gold buyer money changers, with their anti-defamation league of their time, was worried about America, and they forced the conditions upon the King of England, already overextended in the processes of empire, and controlled by the moneylenders who dominated every kingdom in Europe, by withdrawing or extending the essential gold without which armies had been trained not to march. Thus it was when they continued to raise our tax. You remember that over a tax on tea, we made the breaking point. And over this tax, we suddenly revolted with the Declaration of Independence and our refusal, of course, to be taxed without proper representation. The amazing thing is today that you are paying 4.5 to 5 times as much tax as you declared you would never pay when you struck for revolution in order to have proper representation in your taxation. And I tell you that you don't have any more representation in your taxation today than you did when you fought the revolution. Oh, you said that we do, Dr. Smith. We have a Congress in the United States, and we send our congressmen there, and they have to vote on this revenue, and they have to vote on this dispersion. Well, let me tell you something. There's about as much money being confiscated from you and dispersed all over the world as your congressmen ever individually or consciously vote on for any individual prescribed program. I want you to know also that you have about as much chance stopping one of these projects by seeking to influence your congressman, because they are congressmen, or a few congressmen, or a lot of congressmen, say they're against something, and before they're through, they're voting for it because an economic reprisal was promised against their part of the country unless they cooperate. We point out to you that in this individual hour in which we live, one of the strangest of these functions that is being clearly marked, the manipulation of gold, has been one that has become increasingly a problem. Back to the days of President Wilson, we faced one of the great strategies of international Jewry, using Colonel House, who was a peculiar friend of President Wilson and who had unusual power over this map, and using a gradual Jew finance, Jacob Gift backed this column among almost all senators and heavy industrial areas depending on banking finance for assistance. The pressure was placed on the Senate of the United States to suddenly establish a system known as the Federal Reserve Banking System. And a great number of people have the idea today that this is a government banking system, that the Federal Reserve System is made up or is directed and is controlled by the federal government, and as such, it belongs to the people of the United States. Nothing is farther from the truth. The Federal Reserve System is a private banking system, dominantly and predominantly Jewish-owned and controlled, and connected with Jewish banks, international banks, and world settlement banks throughout the world. I want you to know that your wise founding fathers determined that the economy of this nation would be established with what was known as a United States congressional banking system, with the just sets of weights and measures prescribed by the Scripture, and therefore prescribed that Congress alone would have the right to establish the value of money and to decree the standards of its exchange. And thus it is that the weight and the value and all that relates to the pattern of money was a congressional responsibility of fiction. Actually, it was so designed that Congress would have the right to distribute money and to control the methods of its distribution. There's only one real legal process in these United States, and I'm going to tell you that a sweeping chain of catastrophes may develop with greater speed than you think, and when it comes, it'll be one of the great emancipation days of history. The peoples of these United States need a United States Bank, which is in the hands of the Congress of the United States, backed with just sets of weights and measures, and one, my friends, that does not pay any profit to anyone for extending this money to the citizen or receiving it back as the citizen repays the money back. The money of the United States government is to be the money of its people, not of a bunch of international bankers to make fortunes over extending it to you and then having the right to deny it to you to hinder or break your production. I want to tell you what would happen if we had suddenly, if Congress established the United States Bank that operated interest-free, it wouldn't cost just 0.1% to operate it. This is known as a fact. And therefore, what would happen if you had to pay the fee of 0.1% as a tax measure to operate your own bank and get out from under all the interest burdens that function on your economy? My friends, you would not think that a great burden had been rolled off of your back economically in these United States. If America established an interest-free, divine, God-constructed economy, every Jew in the United States would be catching a boat or leaving. So you shouldn't refer to it as every Jew. Well, that Daniel marks who Babylon was. Babylon was the head of Gaul. Jesus established who Babylon is, too, because he, in the unveiling of the book of Revelation, establishes Babylon. And he tells us that Babylon is thy merchant, that deceives all the nations, and he's an international fellow, and he's an enemy of Christ, and he's guilty of the blood of all the righteous slain, of all the martyrs of God that have been killed upon the earth. Now, I don't have to stretch your imagination. Jesus, back in Matthew, identified to the Jews at Jerusalem that they were guilty of all the blood of all the righteous slain, from Abel to Zacharias, and all the righteous Christians that would be killed upon the earth. More than that, Jesus identified them, therefore, as Jewry. He identifies Babylon as this people, and the power and force of history Babylon, the ancient satanic conspiracy to control nations by controlling their economy and then ruling them roughshod with this tyranny, is strictly a Jewish national and international origin plot.
Someone said this is disturbing because it creates ill will against the Jews. Well, I don't know any reason why they shouldn't have ill will. Some Christians have forgotten who crucified Christ. It shouldn't be forgotten on St. Patrick's Day. Let me point this out to you. That in this strategy, they established a world acceptance of the values of gold. Now, there's something intriguing about gold. anyone that ever prospected for it, ever planned any of it, ever mined any of it, there is something that keeps them going on, even if they don't know what to do with it after they get it, so they generally can sell it. And sometimes gold does funny things to people. People you think would be most dependable suddenly become undependable when they see a lot of gold in the past, or they see a chance to get a hold of some gold. Seems like Lucifer knew well that gold would become, by the valuation that they had placed upon it, one of the commodities with which great problems would be created in the earth. But in these United States, from the days that we became a nation, we discovered that the enemy was trying to gain control of our economy by Hyman Solomon, who shouldn't be a hero and whose statue should not be in an American park. It's not fit, my friends, to be in a zoo. Hyman Solomon was not a great patriot. He was one of the most cunning, scheming money manipulators of the ancient House of Rothschild. And he defrauded America, and he helped to create an extending fortune for himself and for his heirs at the expense of America, but he was not trying to help. Nor was Samuel Morris, who they joined with him. Nor my friends Alexander Hamilton, who was also a Jew, and a part of a design conspiracy that would have eventually, if it had worked out, turned everything over to their hands. I point out to you that in the instance of the beginning of our nation, when Benjamin Franklin had gone to Europe and secured the essential assistance from wealthy leaders of France, which would have provided the essential money to have carried the revolution to its successful conclusion, he was held and virtually maintained a prisoner in France, while another boat left, and this boat containing powerful representatives of international Jewish banking houses, came to America and joined with Hyman Solomon and Samuel Morris to calm the Congress of the United States out of a tremendous interest debt on the money which Benjamin Franklin had secured for practically nothing. That's why Benjamin Franklin got up on the floor of the Constitutional Convention and said, "Gentlemen, Jews are barbarians." And he said, "We should never permit Jews to become citizens of the United States, for if you do, your children will curse you in your graves while they work in the fields and the Jews are in the counting house." Someone recently, in writing to one of the Jewish newspapers, said that Benjamin Franklin didn't write this because there's no evidence any longer in his writings to prove it. So this Jew must have known a little bit about what happened, because I saw in the 6-day papers in Benjamin Franklin building in Philadelphia, I saw with my eyes the thing which he had written in his own handwriting in a handwritten 6-day paper. And I'll tell you, it's not there now, because the Jews went and tore the page out while the librarian was busy of that very sound, rare old volume in Benjamin Franklin's own handwriting. So they'd be the first ones to know it wasn't there. Don't worry, Benjamin Franklin's word was reported by the thousands as this word spread concerning both his and George Washington's animosity towards ever letting Jews get any control of the economy of the United States, and the reprehensible trick that's been played to make this possible at the beginning of our country. And I tell you today that there are men that during the time of Roosevelt to this time are still controlling a tremendous debt which has passed down from generations by not having to take the capital and letting the interest mound up at given periods of time until you owe more tonight to the inheritors of the debt of the revolution. You owe more tonight than the amount of money they loaned America at the time of the revolution many times over, though you have paid this debt over 9 times over. I think it's a rather significant thing that while we're not going to do all the ramifications that involved in the great world conspiracy of sending over to the United States the Frankfurters and some of the others in order that they might be a part, along with a great number of these strange influences of that time, or the Irvings and the Kuhn Loeb Company, and a great number of these men came over on a direct design to take over the economy of the United States, directed from the international Jew cabals of Europe. Now listen. In your production and in the creation of your standards, you reached the point where you had fixed for a number of years the value of a gold dollar. You had established the value of an ounce of gold at $20. And you had a little over 25 grains
of gold in a dollar of American currency. But this currency alone was not what was backing the wealth of America. You also had silver dollars, and these silver dollars were pegged to a given amount of grains of silver. But more than this, these coins circulated in your midst. If you wanted to carry the money in your pocket, you could carry the gold and silver. Probably did you no more good than the paper now in your pocket was heavier to carry. You could look at it. You did nothing with it. You couldn't deface money. You were not allowed to melt it up, so therefore you had to carry it, hold it, or save it. So whether you had it or had the paper didn't make too much difference, except that this represented what you were told was so much wealth. Now, actually, it never was established to your nation or to you as an individual that this was wealth until it secured for you the goods that you wanted to consume, that you had worked or by the application of your energies or your enterprise and initiative had acquired the money in its production. We point out to you then that this was a standard of value. People could go out and they could work and they could evaluate just about how many bushels of wheat and how much of the necessary bolts of goods and of clothing could be acquired. If they lived in the city, the community, they could understand about how they could exchange their wages in terms of silver or gold for soup or for food or for housing or for commodities. And people were taught thrift and they were taught responsibility, and the homes of a growing America were a great center of American economy. And parents and families worked together, and sons were interested in securing their parents, and parents were interested in the development of their sons. The acquisition of knowledge was also seen as a requisite for the family. Many times families pooled their excess money to educate in some special way some member of the family, who in turn felt a definite obligation towards the structure of the family. I tell you that probably one of the strongest economic units in the nation is the loyalty of the family and the divine benediction that God has placed upon the structure of the family as the basic unit of society. I tell you today that when families assume their proper responsibility, when the economy of nations runs strong and we are not being taken by the parasites, we don't have to worry about heavy taxations for social security. We don't have to worry about all the processes which are today a part of a socialist design to get us to depend more and more upon bureaucratic control in a new area of government. For bureaucracy today has largely been made up of money masters and international designers of political intrigue working for world mastery and eventually the surrender of your nation and your constitution and your protected bill of rights, that they might reduce you to economic and social slavery under their mastery. So to do this, they get men to surrender their liberties. They promise and promise and promise. Lucifer is a great promiser, but he's a poor deliverer because, as Jesus said, he's a liar and the father of liars, and his children are just like that. Now, there are many people today who say yes, but of course the Social Security system is more a pattern of investment. It's like insurance. Well, you've invested it with some poor keepers then because they've squandered your money, spent it, and taxed you now for the continued supply of what they pay out because they haven't put to work as an investment company should have than the money you put in their hands. I tell you, if you handled your personal affairs like the United States government today in the hands of the left that handles theirs, you'd all be in the penitentiary and there'd be nobody on the outside to keep you. Within the strange significance of this thing through which we pass, we watch the building up of the reservoirs of supply. The billions of dollars of gold that went into the ground at Fort Knox and other great storage centers. People didn't want to carry it around. They were just as happy with a golden certificate. And then came the true manipulated depression, when suddenly the crashing of stocks and the selling of America short, the design to crash it, was a phenomenal experience as they suddenly, money masters, pulled the money out from under the nation. They could never have accomplished this had it not been for the fact that we had been betrayed by senators who didn't know what they were doing and by Jewish pressure and power under Colonel House in the days of Wilson when we set up the Federal Reserve System, who had the power to pull the finance out from America and join together with international financial conspirators to give you the Great Depression. Remember 1933?
one of the first things that was done by the Congress after they had elected the spellbinder that had been selected by international jury to be the first to head their start towards America's complete socialism. This is when the New Deal came into being and everybody was singing the praises of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Well, one of the first things they did in 1933 was to reduce the amount of gold in the American dollar. In order to have more dollars to spend, they told you, it doesn't make any difference really. They said, well, what difference does it make to you? Whether that paper dollar you've got in your pocket is backed by 25 grains of gold or 15 and 2,400 grains of gold. What difference does it make to you? Just so you've got the dollar. And if we can therefore raise the price of gold, they raised the price of gold to $35 an ounce, but they reduced the gold content of the dollar from 25.33 to 15.24. In other words, when in that Agricultural Reconstruction Act of 1933, they misguided and Jew-led Congress of the United States influenced the President, the Congress of the United States, to pass this bill. And under the Agricultural Reconstruction Act, President Roosevelt was told to therefore increase the amount, the price of gold, devaluate the United States dollar. What he did and what that design did was to take away 40% of all the savings that people with thrift had saved against their security. It was to cut down 40% all the pensions that people had paid for throughout the course of time. It was, my friends, to devaluate the savings of every bank account and every account for education or for any design or dream that people had. It meant that your government, Jew-led, broke its contract and robbed its people of 40% of all of their money. But all you were told, look, more money, more papers in circulation. And you never saw any great pickup. What happened to that sudden differential in paper? And who got it? How did they do this? It was one of the beginnings of a double set of books. No matter what they did, they seemed to absorb it. But we point this out to you, that that was when gold first then was reevaluated. Now I want to point out something that you may remember. The citizen of the United States had a right, always and previous to this, to go to the bank and place down his gold and eagle paper note and say, I want a gold piece for this. He could have, according to the size of that note, he could have his gold pieces ranging from small $5 gold pieces and even smaller on up to $20 gold pieces and even larger. For there was even the right to draw billets and ingots if you so wanted it. But let me tell you something. His silver would exchange for silver dollars. But for the first time in the history of the United States, international Babylon proved that it had a strange yoke now developing on America. For they said, you will no longer be able to go to the bank and trade in now $35 of your paper and get 1 ounce of the gold where you used to be able to get an ounce for 20 a few days before. You can't keep gold pieces. In fact, a special little measure was made that coin collectors could keep one or two at the most of a given issue. But this was only a special design made because they were cheaper than anyhow, and they did set up the fact that a coin collector could collect them, and everybody turned coin collectors for a while. Then they were not satisfied with this. They started to confiscate the golden certificates. You only had a given period of time to get the paper in. But what about the world? The world with whom we were doing business, the world who was buying American goods, and the world who was selling goods to America and taking American dollars, knew they could trade these dollars for gold or for silver because this was a guarantee upon the face of it. And so since many of these countries did business on the gold standard, they wanted to continue to do business on this standard. And you'll remember that in the things that followed, your government said that you, the American citizen now, you couldn't go down and turn in your American dollars and buy an ounce of gold, but any foreigner of any country outside the United States could take its payment of American dollars, cashed in, and get it in gold. The United States would back its word with honor, not for you, the citizen, but for the world. This is the time you should have thought about necktie parties. Anytime you as a nation decide that there are more benefits for the people outside than those on the inside, it's time to have a new revolution, rewrite the Constitution. The ensuing business politics will watch through the years of depression a continual extension and a continual decline. You will note that always the gaining of control of industries and the gaining of control of all the gold seem to be one of the major projects. Gold has disappeared, and gold mines were flourishing to try to produce as much gold as they could at $35 an ounce. It wasn't long before they found that they couldn't get as much with the $35 that they used to get with the $20. For inflation had set in, and the inflation passed up the evaluation of the gold. No one had any benefit out of it but gold miners, and theirs was not to last too long. I point out that at that time, the United States government's total budget was not within one-tenth of what that budget is during World War II, and it was not within one-twentieth of what the budget is today. Of course, you understand the processes of increasing inflation. At the present time, the government of the United States has expended more money, for instance, during the years of the Korean War and under Mr. Truman's administration, than has been spent by all of the presidents of the United States, including President Roosevelt, before. And now, I point out that at that time, the United States government's total budget was not within one-tenth of what that budget is during World War II, and it was not within one-twentieth of what the budget is today. Of course, you understand the processes of increasing inflation. At the present time, the government of the United States has expended more money, for instance, during the years of the Korean War and under Mr. Truman's administration, than has been spent by all of the presidents of the United States, including President Roosevelt, before. And now the cost per year of your budget is greater by twice what it was in the greatest height of the war years. And the president's budget for 63 and 64 are not only the highest budgets that have ever been placed before the people, all been printed if they so desire from the mint in their behalf, as they have actual deposits or money turning over in their hands. They can loan your money 10 times to you, borrowing it once as a principal from the government, multiplying it by 10, throughout the course of a fiscal year, return back to the government the single loan with its application of light interest, and have drawn from the people at 6% interest, 60% of their total production through the year by turning over their money. People say, no, it's only 6% or 4%. Turn it over 10 times now and see what percentage amounts it of the original money that belongs to you. Now, in order to keep the money that's moving around good, they've established this fashion, that the right of people that take to have certain amounts of money on demand is recognizable, and we should always have a silver reserve for the silver dollars that are in circulation or carry their own reserve, but the paper ones that say silver certificates can be by demand at any bank, you're supposed to be paid off in silver. But gold, no, you can't get gold. And we were at the end of the war, in fact, even just as far back, I believe, as 1958 to be exact, we happened to have at that time $21 billion reserve of gold in the United States Treasury. Now, I think that you should know that for the Federal Reserve notes extended by the government, not multiplied by multiple risks, you have to have 25% of that in gold in the Treasury. This is a requirement. So at no time could you have less than $12 billion in gold to cover 25% of the extended reserve notes. Now, you said, what really backs our money? Well, frankly, much of this is not backed like you think. Well, actually, the wealth that America creates, the things that it builds, and the permanency of that wealth with a deteriorating scale is the wealth of America. If you build a house, the house is wealth. It's demonstrated by the fact that you get security for money that's extended for you to you. If you want to establish wealth, the crops which you produce are wealth. The machines and all the things of industry which you create, this is real wealth. Because it is for this that you have created much paper, and it is for this and by this that you move these goods. Now we point out to you that the economy of the United States, to stay strong, has to have a minimum of $12 billion on the inside to back our own money. And then we have to have, and we must maintain, a credible balance of gold. If we are going to do business with the world on the basis of such a gold standard, and we must keep an equitable balance in the processes of exchange. I want you to know tonight that if you are buying more goods from the outside than you are exporting dollar-wise, then they can demand by extending to you these dollars, gold out of your treasury, and your gold goes down. If this in itself, therefore, would have to be a modulating factor between the initiative and creative abilities and technology of your society to get a better production and to produce it economically, but superior. If you want the world's markets, you will have to be able to compete with the world's price. Your enemy decided that by the manipulation of labor, they were going to create conditions for higher and higher and higher wages, which would be added onto the goods, both at the producer, at the wholesaler, at the distributor, until actually, before long, a large part of these gains would be lost in the expanding inflation of goods. For it isn't long before prices have passed up the gains, and thus gradually, by a design and an engineering technique discussed by your own enemies in their 7-year and 9-year plans, they helped to organize the pricing of American goods out of the reciprocal trade markets of the world. So today, no one's going to pay more to produce for your goods produced here than the same goods produced at a different labor scale inside of Germany or other countries. So it's been yet that they don't have a purchasing power. Well, strangely enough, because their goods are not priced so high and there is a closer pattern of exchange, they have practically as much purchasing power. The instance has been that we have watched the strange design of our enemy. They designed to involve us and entrap us in wars of great destruction, and then accomplish the building up of the areas of political power they wanted. The Red Revolution has been theirs from the beginning. The international money masters are not my friends on the side of the capitalists, unless you want to evaluate that communism is a Jewish imperialistic type of capitalism that actually is a chicanery of usurious cunning exchange. The shock troops of international Jewish banking is the Red Revolution. The fifth column is their international areas of business and conduct, and especially is this through the marks of the United Nations. Their design is to use the implementation of the mass manpower of the world to bring them to your knees if they can't do this by economic catastrophe and by the agreement of submission to international agreements of the United Nations. Then threatening you with the dangers to your very security, they ask you to join in surrendering all your weapons, so that you won't have to worry about whether you're going to be secure or not. You're going to be a slave anyhow. We have gone through the craziest years of history. When we ended and entered into the 1950s, we had just emerged for a great period of posting, shall we say, prosperity to the degree that America, with wages in its pocket, unable to spend them for all the goods it wanted because of war years, because of the decrease in production, now wanted to buy. So they started to buy, and they did buy, and until they had bought, and the saturation point of their expenditures had about been reached, and they had new washing machines and televisions and automobiles and all the things they needed to replace in their houses and homes, and so you sailed from the end of the war to the 1950s in a good economic cycle of what looked like prosperity in spite of the enemy. At the same time, he was evaluating how far this would run. And as this prosperity began to sag, you suddenly discovered that you were launched into 100 projects under the two United Nations to help the whole world. You were being told that if you wanted to have great production so you could ship your goods all over the world, you had to make these areas prosperous so they could buy it. Why did you have to make them prosperous? I do not know what value the merchant would get if he had to distribute his money all over town so people would come and buy in his store. That's the principle that you apply. And thus it is that you as a people were told that this was your social responsibility. You had to make every Hottentot tribe in Africa, you had to make every nation in Europe, you had to make every part of Asia wealthy and powerful and economically strong. But how do you do this? You start taxing and increasing the taxes of the peoples of the United States so that from the goods they produced and the income they gained, great lots of taxes were taken from it, given to the world to buy back their goods. So what you do is you tax yourself to give your goods away. I want you to know, for an equitable dollar balance, everything you have to give away and don't get back your the money for, and don't get back not your money but theirs, my friends, is a fallacy from the standpoint of prosperity. Someone said, well, we've helped all these goods out. They told us that if we didn't do this, the country would go communist. The communists, with their agents, told you if you didn't give away your strength and your finances, the world would go communist, and they knew that they never could take the world until they took you first. And so they were trying to economically destroy you by having you give away your wealth and reduce your resistance power so they could take over throughout the world. This is mystery babbling you're dealing with. Satan says, this is my household. God says, this is your cunning deadly enemy. I want you to know that you gave away billions and billions and billions of dollars. You have not only given it away, but you have given the money to your allies round about to build their industry. You took conquered Japan and you put back into conquered Japan first-class industries of every kind. You built them and you subsidized them, and now they, with plants as good and sometimes superior to yours, with great scales that are not encumbered by the high unionistic demands of yours, and not manipulated for the high taxes you have, can sell goods to America for 50% less than you can produce some of these goods for. The result is you lost markets to a competitor that you financed with tax money. You say, why did Babylon want to do this? Because it was interested first in seeing that this eagle came down. Now I want you to know that whereas you have to have $21 billion, you have $21 billion, that's what you're supposed to have, and what you had in 1958. Now, the matter of interest to know that 6,802,484,879 of your gold reserve in 1958 passed over into foreign hands. They suddenly decided that America was not as sound and that its industries were slacking, its costs were high, the dollar exchange was more valuable than the whole American dollar. The world never worried about American dollars before the economy was strong. They didn't have to have your gold, your paper was good. But communism now was spreading gold all over the world from the Lake Bacali region, and at the same time it was trying to degrade your the structure of your economy, and you were dispelling your strength. So suddenly they called for $6 billion worth of American gold. The $6 billion went out. In 1963, our total gold reserve is now, as of this last January, $15,978,113,000. Now, since the law says you have to have $12 billion in your reserve to back your money, then you had left, after you've imputed this $12 billion, you only had to have $4 billion in gold reserves in January. $4 billion is all you had if you backed your money with what the law requires. Now listen. Representative Clarence Canyon, who happens to be Cannon, happens to be chairman of the Appropriations Committee of the House. You know where we stood in January of 1963? $4 billion worth of gold over and for foreign claims over and above what we have to back our money. Now, we have an owe to foreigners because we have been giving away our money. And these insane leaders of your government who need the mental health bills they're asking for themselves have given away $21 billion worth of what remains until foreigners all over the world, few bankers, hold $21 billion worth of claim against the $16 billion you got left. So if they now call in this vote America will not only be bankrupt, but she doesn't have enough money to give them theirs and have anything to back yours and the money in your pocket if they fall for this gold isn't worth a thing.
Well, he says, I got money in the bank. He says, think you've got money in the bank. You've got some paper down there that the merchants of Babylon have already gained all of the metal backing behind it in London. Say, what ought the people in the United States to do? How do we combat this situation? What's the next thing in design? Even New Dealer Cannon said, I was a great friend of Roosevelt. I was a great friend of Mr. Kennedy. But there's something unsound and unstable about this budget message. Who tells us that we can't cut off foreign aid, but we can limit it a little, but we can't cut it off because they have to be prosperous to buy our goods, and we're losing money every deal. Who tells us that we've got to reduce our taxes, and we must reduce them irrespective of what we do to the deficit, and that continually cuts down on what's there all the time. I think we ought to cut taxes. I think we ought to cut expenditure. I think we ought to stop giving another dollar away to any country on the face of the earth except in an hour of an emergency and out of the gratitude of your heart. I want you to know that this is fundamental. That you may assist any other Christian nation, which is of the household of God. And this is also responsible for you in an hour of their emergency, but you're not supposed to support either the members of the household of nations, or you're not supposed to give to your enemies anything. More than this, the Declaration of Independence, that you are free from the economic bondage of any country on the face of the earth. And you as a citizen, under the protection of the Articles of Confederation by which you came together, and the foundation for your constitution, no tax could ever be levied against you for the support of any foreign power or for the contribution to any nation outside of these United States. Well, you see, every time it's given away, it's a felony. Every time your money is distributed outside the United States to the Hottentots or in all over Latin America, now they're trying to come up here, Boulart wants several billion dollars to help this immediate alliance for progress, and he was a little unhappy the other day because we weren't quite as fast towards handing it out as we promised the previous billions to Brazil. Everybody today that has been elevated in favor by the administration under the Alliance for Progress to get billions of dollars, whether you're freely given foreign aid, is a socialist or socialist. And the man we've just rated before the nation as the outstanding example of a statesman of South America is Communist Benacar. Let me point this out to you. At any time, the signal can be given, and they can bankrupt the United States financially on its present economic system. Someone says, do you think that money is something that is going to be savable over any period of time? The only way it will be savable is if you establish it on something that's not sure. The government of the United States, the Congress of the United States, would reassume their responsibility. They don't have to vote out the Federal Reserve System. They all have to do is create a United States Bank. All they have to do is start issuing dollars that are backed up by American production and loan them to the field of production and retire them without interest. They can build dams with it, and they can build great projects with it, and they can repay or take back out of circulation the redemption by the energy output of the thing they have created. This has been done before. You build a great dam, you don't charge it up forever for taxes, and then make a big huge profit on the bonds. If you build a big dam, you sell the power. When you sell the power, you distribute it through private enterprise at a profit that's reasonable and not 700% and 800%, and you retire the cost of the dam by taking back the money that you created when you built it, and you have the wealth without one tax dollar invested. And this is so well understood that the Jews were afraid you were going to find out how it works in Germany, and they tried to destroy the economy of Germany before it got going. You know,
know where they got the idea? From the United States constitutional money system, which we've never trusted. I tell you, there's something else that you must recognize. Well, as a free economy has coinage moving around, if you want gold, you have a right to have it. You have silver and your nation's produced any, you have a right to have it. But the real value should be an abiding check against the production that you can take in the commodities produced. I tell you, America's wealth is in its land, its homes, its factories. It's in the things you've made, and according to their ability to last, against the pattern of their deterioration, your wealth, therefore, is thus checked. Under the program of God's kingdom, there should be a dollar in distribution to buy every dollar's worth of goods there is to sell. I'm going to tell you that the days ahead are going to be days of plenty, not of scarcity, because when they think they're going to pull the financial rug from out of the United States, America, by this time, through every type of communication tape and otherwise, is going to know who did it. There's going to be a great human cry. It's going to rise up in America, and people are going to say, we're not going to have this Jew depression, no matter who they use to steer it. You know, when factories shut down and people go out of work and they say there's no money. Then when they want to start a war and they have somebody they want to destroy and there's all kinds of money, factories are going, everybody goes back to work and you learn something. From one moment depression to a few months and you were in prosperity, all because somebody was passing out the paper. America should have learned a lesson by now that if they can suddenly start everything moving because these money masters passed out the paper, if you take another depression by letting them take the paper away or determine what your economic destiny is going to be, then you need your heads examined completely. Well, I can assure you this. These Jews burned down one government building the day before election because they were afraid that that election was going to establish a government bank. And it didn't do them any good because the government bank was established the next day anyhow. They probably burn everything down if they thought they were going to lose their interest burden of 30% and more on all of the loans effectively that they eventually managed after they have checked out the original amount of your currency they've been using. Someone said, you mean we don't have to destroy the Federal Reserve? Who would go down the Federal Reserve to get a loan when you could get interest-free money backed on a properly assessed investment for the production of your society? Someone said, it wouldn't work. Well, if it wouldn't work, then no government, no investment by any financial institution will work. Someone said, Dr. Smith, what can you do with money? Well, there's a lot of things you can do with money. You can buy good land with money, and then pay taxes on it. This is the problem that makes it always an investment that must be carefully evaluated. That it must be an area where the taxes are not high unless the property bought is paying the taxes and making it profit. The profit it makes, it must be able to make on the use of the land. Or upon its increasing value as the patterns of inflation holds the same. We show you, therefore, that that is always a solid investment, except for the tax factor. It's possible that manipulations, organized and directed, move the areas of prosperity from one side of land to another. This is something they have learned to do. On the other hand, there are other things which we point out to you tonight. That the businesses and the industries of America that are not in debt to the international bankers are always a good investment because they are always producing goods. And the history of the last depression shows that people that owned American industry fared better than anybody else because while 13 to 15 million people were out of work, the rest of the people had to buy the commodities and necessities upon which a nation ran, and the profit for producing them was distributed between the owners. It doesn't make any difference what happens on the market as the price goes up and down on stock, and that stock is related to the manipulator. It is only the important investment in the kind of companies that are producing whose profit is always dispersed back to the owners. Now, I cite that there are lots of things to remember. If you think you're going to save a dollar, you're not going to save a dollar unless you save America. You're not going to be able to save your dollars if you don't save America, and you're not going to save America until you break the power of the golden Babylon. Someone said, are you against a a gold standard. I am against the standard that hinges all of America's currency to gold or to any commodity in the face of the vastness of America's production. But I believe in just such a waste of measures that you can interexchange in gold or silver if you desire. And I'm sure that you would rather have the product and the check against it because you can't eat the gold or the silver. But the enemy knows this. I think it's time that America, not only as a society, awakened to their responsibility, and that every Christian American said not another merchant of Babylon is going to give away our money so he can run outside and pick it up and then demand from us its security. I think that across America, Christians everywhere should start a great political movement not to elect another candidate that wants to give away our wealth. Someone says, suppose they start calling for our wealth. I think it's time that we took a very firm position. Just tell the world now, world, there's something you're going to have to know. We haven't any gold to give away anymore. But we have production. If the goods we have to sell you want to buy, you can exchange dollars for it. We gave almost all these dollars away anyhow. We better earmark and specially catalog the kind of dollars that go into circulation by such a force. The time has come when it is more important that you save America than you save all the hottentots and Asiatics in the world. I can assure you this, that if your economy was based on production with the backing of that kind of a divinely ordained system of money, that even if they had the gold, it wouldn't affect your economy. And when you got through, you'd have the gold back again. Babylon, which tonight thinks they're going to crush America economically while gathering the hordes of military power to destroy it, is getting ready for an economic coup. I want you to realize tonight that there is no formula of absolute security. They have designed that they're going to suddenly try to pull the rug out from under American business. If they compute they're going to export so many goods into the from Europe to the United States, they're going to close your factories. People in the United States have one recourse then, and that's to protect by tariff, not by the program of the administration, the walls of American production. And understand tonight that God has so bountifully blessed this nation that you are self-sufficient. There is nothing that you have that you don't produce it right here in the United States. And if you didn't have one bit of trade on the outside of the United States and you had no foreign aid to give away, you'd be more prosperous in 24 months than you have been for some long period of time. They suppose they want to buy our wheat. They'll let them bring their gold and their jewels and come and buy. Oh, you say, well, suppose India needs wheat. Let me tell you something. Those Maharajas and that government and even Mr. Nehru and Chris Salman have more wealth and more jewels and more gold in their lockers than the capital wealth of your nation in actual gold and silver and precious stones. You are always being told to give to these people. Well, I heartily agree. If they want lots of wheat to eat, why don't they dump some of that security over here in our locker? Because God has warned you that you are not duty-bound to support pagans. You're not helping them out. You're just supporting them in their era. The flight of gold is an economic disaster if you're going to pitch your hope on Babylon's borders. And if you've decided that you're going to face the Babylon and say, we've had enough, then freeze it anyhow. Someone says, that'll make the devil mad. Well, that doesn't hurt. You know, the best thing could happen to America if he got real mad and the split came now. Therefore, they think they've reached the time when no man will buy or sell. But there is no cycle ahead. Even though it says that in Babylon, now in Babylon is the millstone going to cease to burn. You see, God's got a few little designs in the background that he understands. If you think that God's lost his omniscience, if you think he doesn't know how to handle this situation, let me tell you something. God Almighty has a design to crumble Babylon. He has a design to so empower you with understanding and initiative that you produce a great Christian self-sufficient economy. And if they are dried up from draining you, they will, as parasites, die on their own bush because they've never produced themselves. We point out to you that they have launched a system, which we haven't the time to discuss tonight, in the cities of the Antichrist. They hope to economically control them all and individually, and thus you as a citizen individually is under a great world satanic design. It also is going to fail, but God has a strategy here. He said that the hour is going to come when the wrath that rises up from your countenance is not going to leave a Canaanite in the house of God. And it's pretty hard to do business, whether you're on Main Street or whether you're on Wall Street in New York, if you're not here. Not going to be a Canaanite left in the house of God. Babylon's millstones are going to cease. In one moment, its entire international program is going to come to a standstill because God said, I'm going to bring my judgment down upon her like great hailstones. You're all going to wake up and find that Babylon was thy merchant, not the man that friend of your family you've known for years, that is Anglo-Saxon or Scandinavian or Nordic. Babylon was thy merchant, your international merchant. He was thy moneylender. He was identified by his attitude towards Christ, towards Christians, and towards your civilization. Now God said he's going to speak. He said, how do I survive? You take the advice that God gives you and don't depend on Babylon's money. Until it's anchored to not Babylon's anger, but God's blessing, production, to initiative into America. I've got lots of faith in America, but I have no faith in its manipulators. Now listen. In 1 hour shall that great Babylon fall. And when Babylon's millstones start to slow down, and its conspiracies end, America's millstones are going to start turning. America's going to have all the things that it knows how to buy and it knows how to build, and the world's going to have all the things that can be produced for it. And as Babylon's power is broken, you're going to see, my friends, the reactivity again of every enterprise in God's kingdom. So I point out to you that the plight of gold is a conspiracy. It's a part of the communist program. And you know, the most fantastic thing is to see a man of wealth like the Kennedy, who supports a policy that will disinherit every last man of wealth in America when they get through. I'll tell you this tonight. That America can stop every one of these conspiracies if every Christian tonight will say we've had enough. In fact, you can plague with letters in one single week and enough congressmen and senators in America to realize that America's murmuring. You can plug every loophole with money going out by repudiating this. You know, a man can't give money away when he doesn't have it. No sense you try to tell the world you've got your pocket full of it because the Jews have it and you don't have it. And if the Jews want to give their money to the rest of the world, you stand back and say, wonders we'll never see. No wonder we can say, Lord Jesus, come quickly, even so come, Lord Jesus. We haven't time to finish this subject. We will talk to you next Sunday night on the cities of the Antichrist. This tremendous design and world conspiracy is of great significance. The purposes and the plans of God and the surviving order is also clearly unveiled as we see the comparative strategy. We'll be speaking tomorrow night in San Francisco in the Native Sons Auditorium, Tuesday night in the auditorium on Harrison, the Key System Auditorium, Wednesday in the YWCA, Thursday night in San Diego, and Friday back here as we cover a group of the world events as they relate to biblical prophecy. There's never been a period where it is more important for us to understand this. Next Sunday afternoon, we're going to talk upon the health from celestial planes. This is very vital to understand, for throughout all ages, there have been help from celestial planes. In this vital hour that we are in, it is help from celestial planes that's going to strengthen the kingdom for these final hours of its service and ministry before it administers the affairs of the world. Remember, the kingdom's not going out down, it's going up. It's not going to leave the earth, it's going to rule over it. This is God's purpose. Then next Sunday night, we talk about cities of the Antichrist. This is our strategy.
to discuss with you what is the design of the enemy and cause you to know where the cities are even today that rule their hour with the beast. The scripture says that there's a very special destiny for them. We're going to talk to you about the plan, the design, the cities of the Antichrist. We are reaching people across the nation, as you know, as we never have been able to reach them before. The installations of this week will equip us as we had not anticipated we would ever be able to reach people in the speed of tape production. Now we've got to have money. We've got to have thousands of dollars. We can use and distribute more tape than we've ever been able to distribute before. Say, how much tape could you put out? We can put out $2,500 worth of tape a week. And we can do more than that in a little while, but we can put out $2,500 worth of tape a week now. We could roll 2,000 tape a week for the installation of the equipment that is going in this very week. Now, we don't have to roll that amount of tape, but we will be rolling 1,000 tape a week very, very quickly. We've got demands and calls and tape lists just waiting for the ability to reach them with tape right now. And the money to reach these people with tape to help roll this program along. Now, this isn't something we want one person to do. This is something we want everybody to join in helping to do with ties and with offerings and help reach other people. Reach them with faith and tell them about it. We make one announcement to you that One Electronics Concern is making available tape recorders for $59 that will play these tapes or record them. It's basically playing these tapes and will give you also 3¾ to 7½ speed. Now, the reason we announce this is because it means nothing to us to sell these machines. We're only disposing and bringing these machines to you from the distributor who will make them available to you at this low cost. So that if people want to carry them to their friends and their neighbors, they can do this. It's priced down where anybody across the nation, anybody out in the tape circuit that wants a tape machine, can secure a tape machine for this cost in the sales tax. It's all that's involved in getting a tape recorder. We urge you to play tape to reach people, congregations, groups, friends, homes, patriotic movements, and get these tapes in where people will discuss them, and this is a vital and important project that you can carry on for God's kingdom. So we need your tithes, we need your offerings tonight. This is inclement weather, but you'll come out in the face of it. Many people are frightened when we get a little weather in California, but we've been waiting a long time for some of this weather. And so we ought to be happy about it, and we ought to be thanking God for it. And so we urge you with your tithes and offerings to hold up our hands and to help meet the budget to fill out the empty vacancies in those that should have been here this week. Help us to reach people and pray for the extension and speed of this program. Do not forget XERB 1090 on the dial every day at 9:15, the voice of truth. Almighty and eternal God, our Father, invoke the unction of thy Holy Spirit and blessing to rest upon this congregation and bless this offering. Multiply it to the purpose of carrying forward the gospel of thy kingdom to do the work of thy church. Let it be us. Amen.